is now.
Capital 263.
Welcome to Politics and Beyond on Capital 263. My name is Christopher Farai Charamba.
And I am Tawanda Henry Biti.
Yeah, welcome to yet another episode of the best political podcast in the country, in Africa. We're claiming it. You know, we're moving beyond. We're going cross-continental. You were just listening to the sounds of the late, great comrade Chinks Chingaira. May his soul rest in peace. We thought that it would be a great tribute to start off with a little bit of Comrade Chinks. Chikopo Kopo is one of my favorite songs. That's why I played it. So today is the 21st of June, 2017. Let's not go back to last year. We've got a guest with us in the studio, good friend of mine, Mukoma Zua Matondo. Welcome.
Hello, guys. Thank you for having me. My name is Zua Matondo, as Chris just said, and it's an honor to be here with you guys.
Yeah, so on today's show, we're going to talk about Comrade Chinks. I'm just going to give a bit of his history and background, you know, what he's done and why I believe he should have been named a national hero. I'll get the other guys' opinions on that. And also, what else do we have, Henry?
We'll speak about, you know, a picture going around, doing the rounds online right now, and the general concept of, you know, a streamlined cabinet. And then I think that besides that, and some local news and a couple of things going on in the Herald regarding their personnel.
Why are you always wanting? Why must it always be about the Herald, Sha? Just because I work there, it becomes an issue. But anyway, yeah, let's.
And we'll give Zua a chance to speak about this really incredible initiative that he's a part of, and. Has begun called Governance Africa. And yeah, I can only even just say the name. He'll give us a complete view of what that is and how, you know, perhaps our listeners can get involved and what we can all do to really take part.
Yeah, so that's the show, as you know and as you've come to love it. Thank you to all our listeners. So Comrade Chinks, most people know him for, you know, for the music that he's put out. He's put out quite a lot of songs, but he's been a member of the ruling party ZANU-PF. He went to the war. He was born in 1955, September 27, 1955. He was actually born Comrade Dick Chingaira Makoni. Well, not the comrade part. Dick Chingaira Makoni was his name, but I don't know where in the mix, it, you know, people started calling him Dixon, and that sort of stuck. But his actual name is Dick. He grew up in Rusape. That's where he did his primary school, at Chigora Primary School. Then he went to Bulawayo for his secondary education. And after that, he, you know, got a job for a while in 1974, and he wanted to go and become a doctor. But those plans to study medicine abroad didn't work out. Colonial times, getting papers to leave the country was a problem, and so he was unable to do that. So in about 1975, he decided, you know what, let me go and join the liberation struggle, because that's what a lot of the young people were doing. And he went over there, and from a young age, he was a lover of music. So when he got there, he just, you know, because he had this passion, he joined the Takawira Choir, which then became known as the Zanla Choir. And at the time it was under the leadership of Comrade Mereyarira Mzimbabwe. And after a while, because of his talent and because of his passion, Comrade Chinks then became the leader of this Zanla choir. And he composed a lot of songs. One of the ones that they sang, and there's a video of it. Maru Zaimi was sang at Zapasi. What was it called? Where the after the war, when I think early 1980s or when the war ended in 1979, they came back to this Zapasi center or place. I'm forgetting the actual name for the place in Buhera, and you know, all these comrades were coming back from the war, and some of the British or the Rhodesian forces and leaders came through, and Comrade Chinks is seen in this video, and he's singing the Maru Zaimi, literally telling them you lost, and he says all sorts of things about the shape of their nose and all sorts of things.
he was witty.
Yeah, dude, he was very witty, and it was quite great. And then after that, a lot of comrades were in the 1980s after independence, got jobs in state institutions. So he went to ZBC and he worked there in as a technician for a few years, but he never stopped making music. He teamed up with Benny Miller, and you know, they formed a band. That's when he recorded his songs Ngorimba, Shukomborero, Nerudo. He then joined up with Ilanga, Don Gumbo as well. Andy Brown was also part of that band from about 82 to 87, and they were, you know, they were all under the same record company. So, and I think it was the one of the first integrated record companies in Zimbabwe, and they were all making music. You know, he had a stint with
that Jikumbrero song is probably my first experience, or how I first came across him. I think that's, for me personally, that's probably, or maybe even for, if there's others like me, because I would like to think that my story is not necessarily, you know, it's a sort of atypical of sort of our age group, is around Jukumburero, and that period is probably where we'd know him more from than obviously necessarily his work during the Liberation War.
Yeah. And then I think it was in 1989 or early 1990s, he recorded Roja Confirm, which is, I think, one of the songs that a lot of people know him from, with Mazana Black Spirits. It was, you know, spent 25 weeks on the Radio 3's hit pick charts. And then, you know, he continued with his life, was still making music. And then Muramba Tshina happened around the 2000, what year was that? 2005, I think. And, you know,
it was 2005, yeah.
Yeah, so before that, actually, when Wondo Yeminda started, he went back into the studio. He'd been working at ZBC as a transmission controller. Went back into the studio, recorded more songs, you know, to do with liberation, more to do with the land reform, in support of the land reform. I actually think Chikopo Kopo was recorded around that time. I'd have to check. But, you know, it's interesting. In some of the lyrics, they say a lot of things. Mwamgabe avanao kanganisa, my youth avanao kanganisa, my mujuru avanao kanganisa. Which then is quite funny, because now Vakanganisa, or according to the party. But then, yeah, 2005, his house was destroyed in Muramba.
I think there's a picture. I wish we could link to it, of him sort of near his house. I think it's in Chitungwiza, which had just been destroyed as part of Operation Muramba Tshina.
Yeah, but, you know, and that's a sad part, and something we'll get into in terms of, you know, this man is a war veteran. He's gave his life pretty much for, you know, the country, for the liberation of the country. He gave his life to making music for ZANU-PF, even when, you know, there was all that animosity and all that controversy surrounding land reform. There was so much that he continued to contribute, and something like this then happens to him. He was then, you know, I think he continued to, you know, still make music, and he performed at a number of galas and all sorts of things. That's also somewhere where you'd get to see him, the Mdalawe to Gala, and all these things that used to happen back in the 2000s. And then he fell sick this year. He was in hospital for a while. He also received a house in Maybelline in Sentosa from Joseph Nyadzayo, who is the chairperson of ZIMA, which is Zimbabwe Music Awards. So they were the ones. 3 years ago, they promised him this house, and they finally managed to finish it, and it was donated to him last month. And, you know, as fate would have it, he then succumbed to his illness, and he passed away last week, Friday.
You know, if you like to believe in these things, at least he knew Kuti, his family was in a better position. I guess at least they were in the house. So maybe it was all intentional. He decided to stop fighting at the end there, because at least he knew that they had that house. I was always under the impression that the house was given by the government or had been donated based on certain newspapers' coverage of it.
So Joseph Nyadzayo happens to also be the president's photographer. So I think that's maybe where this whole impression that it was from the government came up, because he works directly in the office of the president in cabinet. But it really did.
Yeah, it really, I guess, I know. My impression came from the fact that it was handed over by
the first lady.
By the first lady, and
but
you know,
but she's not a government official.
I'm sure it's a myth. Pardon?
I said she's not a government official.
By government, I was speaking of the party. I was speaking of the ruling party, is the party in power, which forms the government. In case you didn't know, our system.
look at you taking shots. It's okay. But yeah, so this is the legacy of Comrade Chinks, and unfortunately, you know, he hasn't, unfortunately, and I'll say this to me, he hasn't been named a national hero. He's been named a liberation war hero, which on the list you have national hero, you have provincial hero, and then you have liberation war hero, which used to be called district hero. So it's the lowest of the honors in terms of the hero status. And, you know, there's other people who have been snubbed. Lookout Masuku, Edgar Tekere, to name a couple. And I think this is yet another snub of people who have, you know, gone to, or who have not been given a national hero status. One of the things that, you know, they say is that the Politburo sits and they decide, but the act, the National Hero Act, actually said it is, basically states that it's the prerogative of the president to say who gets to become a national hero. So like most things in this country, the buck starts and stops with the president. He is the one center of power, as they like to say. And so he gets, you know, to make that decision. And I think it's unfair, because to a lot of people, and this is coming from both sides of the political aisle, to a lot of people, Comrade Chinks is a national hero.
Well, yeah, he's certainly more a national hero than, you know, some people that have, you know, like, I think it's, let me go full Lamech on it, and some people that have only gotten in there because of their contribution, you know, to the party during, you know, land redistribution or that whole brouhaha, your comrades, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, your comrades Wunzi, your comrades Bodzagezis, you know, these people, at least in my humble opinion, you know, not to cast aspersions on their families, but generally I think that if one was just being objective of what would make a contribution or come up with a contribution to society, and you know, they're certainly less deserving than he is. And I mean, you mentioned Lookout Masuku and Edgar Tekere. These are in many ways even larger omissions, but I think when you have the likes of Kasukwere Chipanga and these Johnny come lately is having to decide who becomes a national hero in Politburo, then I don't think you're going to end up with anything that's like a legitimate or an you know, a even reasonable system, really.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that you mentioned those two, but you've also got you know, Professor Jonathan Moyo, who's in Politburo, who people said that he ran away from the war. I don't know if Priska Mfumira went. She's also in Politburo. You know, the First Lady Grace Mugabe is there. She didn't go to the war. Who else is there from the list? I can't. I'm not sure about, you know, Mike Bima as well. He's in Politburo. I don't know if he went to the war, but you know, there's all these people now, and it brings into question, what is the criteria? What does one have to do to get national hero status? But you know, it's a very, as I said, the buck stops and starts with the president. So I think personally, I think it's wrong. I think that there really should be a way. There should be a, you know, a ministry or some sort of independent commission actually that determines these things, and there should be certain criteria that one should fulfill. But that said, in the hearts of, you know, the people, myself included, I think, you know, he is a national hero. I don't know, Zua, if you have anything to say, especially on the aspect of national heroes and, you know, what it symbolizes.
Well, I think you brought up the main issues. I actually saw two main issues as you guys were discussing. The first one being, what is the objective criteria for a national hero, you know? And then number two, who gets to decide? So basically, are we going to look for people who were in the struggle, very familiar with the struggle, even though maybe they were not in the struggle themselves? So I think those are the main two issues. If there is an objective, if there's an objective criteria, who gets to decide that objective criteria? Should there be a public vote, perhaps, if someone is put forward? I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're, I think on a, at least I believe on a larger issue, or a, you know, a more policy based issue, eventually it's going to have to come to a point where, you know, a national hero should no longer be defined by your contribution in the liberation war. A lot of people don't meet that criteria, but are no less heroes than, you know, those that have contributed in the war. So at some point, this is going to lose its usefulness. And I think that, you know, it shows Kuti, our government hasn't really evolved to the point where it's considering what's happening, because it's 37 years afterwards. If you were born in 1980, you'd be, you know, 37 now, basically. So how can you, you know, in your short lifetime, I mean, you could have put made such an impact on the country, but you'd never be considered a national hero. So either there's going to have to be another award introduced. And, you know, on the group, I'd suggested maybe a president's medal or something like that to honor people in their lifetimes. Or, I mean, indeed, for better or for worse, just scrapping the whole thing altogether and just letting those in the shrine, you know, rest forever in that shrine. Particularly after we bury the old man in there, and just, you know, just putting the keys on the lock on the gate, and then just calling it a day on that.
Turning it into a museum for those who wish to, you know, because to be fair, there are some people there who, while there are some people there who I don't think should be there, there are some people there who definitely deserved to have gone there.
Yeah, so, I mean, even though I think overwhelmingly, let's be honest, I think most people overwhelmingly in there deserve to be there.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people who are coming deserve to be buried with their kith and kin. but, you know, so that was, and so that, when we decide to go and find people to blame, we can just go into one place, and it's close to our area as well, so we don't have to drive all over the country.
So guys, if we can actually start to discuss what, you know, if the liberation issue is one that soon enough will become outdated to have as an important criteria for a national hero, what other criteria can we begin to have, right? So let's take someone who was born in 1980, they're 37 years old, and they can actually contribute to, you know, our nation culturally, politically, economically, what have you, in a very, very marked way. What, let's start discussing what sort of criteria can actually be used for a person like that. And you mentioned the suggestion of maybe a presidential medal of something, you know. But then, should that be the case? Should we not still keep them as a national hero? Because what is a national hero? You know, is someone who's contributed to, you know, the nation, the progress of our nation, you know, the establishment of our nation, if one would say that as well, which we've already dealt with. But let's push the conversation forward now to what sort of criteria do you think we can have?
I think some of the things that should be discussed is it should be divided into categories, and definitely one of the key things across all categories should be what has been your contribution, a positive contribution to Zimbabwe. So it could be in sport, it could be in, you know, health, it could be in the different sectors that exist, but it must have a national impact. And I think there must be a wide section of society to determine. And I honestly believe that there should be more honoring of people whilst they are alive, because to be fair,
number one,
not everyone will want to be buried at the national shrine. Number two, if we decide to, you know, continue naming heroes in whatever sphere, we're going to run out of space up there on that hill. And also, it has more impact when you have that person with you and you're honoring them for the work that they've done and showing that they are appreciated, because then other people can aspire towards it. I mean, for example, you know, there's a lot of people who really wish they could win a Nobel Prize. You know, in different spheres, you have for literature, you have for economics, you have for science and things like that. And I'm sure the people who have the capacity to win one aspire to win one. So I think that there is more value in having a prize or a commendation
for recognition.
Yeah, for somebody who is actually alive and who is present and, you know, who can also be there to share their story. One thing that I'm disappointed about talking about Comrade Chinks is that there's no book that Chinks wrote about himself. He lives through his music, but his story is also quite an interesting one. From somebody who wanted to become a medical doctor at the age of 18 to someone who then went to the war and led a choir and went to make music, was in one of the first integrated bands in Zimbabwe, in, you know, a new Zimbabwe. There's a story then that we unfortunately don't get to hear in full from him. We get bits and pieces. So I think it's very important to have something for people who are alive.
Henry, you're going to say something?
Yeah, no, I think Chris had valid points there. I think the one caveat I might add is that you know, it's not just enough just for, I think even wider impact in the world certainly should get recognized by the government or by our country. And you know, it's also just seems a bit disingenuous to only be recognizing people when they've passed away, when they're gone. And you know, I don't see whether it's a cultural thing, or what the actual argument for not having a living award is for that. But the criteria, you split it up into sectors, into groups, and the sector basically, or people will stand out in the sectors themselves and put themselves forward, just based, and in this day and age, having an online vote or having things like that for Zimbabwean of the Year, even a Zimbabwean of the Year award, really, like, something like that, that's officially run by the government, is not something that's terribly difficult to do.
Mm. And do you think that people's families should potentially take more of an active role in organizing things like autobiographies being written about their family members who they believe have really made significant contributions to the nation? Or are we also leaving that to the journalists, the historians, the academics as well. Because I've been here, you know, I've maybe heard about two or three people whose families are actively looking to have autobiographies written about them. And I think it's a pity that it has to come from the family as opposed to being recognized by, let's say, the broader historian academia or political academia or what have you. But nevertheless, I think whilst these people are still here with us, as we all have been talking about, it's important. That's an aspect that can really push these people's stories, their contributions, you know, to the general public.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I don't know, I don't really know how, sorry, Chris, I don't to cut you off. I don't know how it works in a number of countries, but we sort of have a missing generation in academia. Certainly, I believe that a lot of the people that would have gone to university and might have drifted towards history or drifted towards journalism and things like this were maybe pushed into, you know, other subjects, law, engineering, economics. So you have, you know, that's one of our problems, is that we haven't really had anyone significantly really be interested in writing, a retrospective of a lot of these people. And I mean, obviously the other thing is the economic situations, is that it's very difficult to justify spending a lot of money in this type of research. But yeah, if the family can do it, I by all means they certainly should, because when an actual, you know, larger histories of certain periods are done, memoirs and things which are, you know, subjective in many ways, which are either written by the person themselves or, you know, or biographies commissioned by the families, which are generally always positive, do form part of the larger lexicon or the larger things that a historian would use to write a history of a period. So I don't see a problem in that.
I think first things first, the story is yours, and if your family should encourage you to tell it. You know, some people are reluctant. And I understand why, especially when it comes to the war. War is a very nasty and brutal thing, and it has a very terrible psychological effect. And in this country, there was no counseling post that period. So a lot of people, you know, shut that period off and never want to relive it. But I think it's important that we have these stories told, because, you know, as we always say, history is always told by the victor. And those who do write become authorities at a certain point in life. So we definitely need to have this out. And credit to Arthur Mtambara, who, wrote something recently. But I think, you know, it's important that we definitely have people writing these things. And, you know, maybe there should be a ministry. One of them, I think we have the Ministry of Culture and something that should be responsible for this, in our case. But, you know, speaking of ministries, we do have to move on to the next part of our topic. So there's this pic that's been circulating. I saw it on Povo Zim on Twitter, and it's a 12-member cabinet for Zimbabwe. It's a proposal. It's got Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Education, Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Justice, Ministry of Industry and Commerce, Ministry of Home Affairs, Ministry of Environment Protection, Ministry of Local Government, Ministry of Infrastructure Development, Labor and Social Development. So that's 12 ministries. I was interested in the proposal. I definitely think we have a very bloated cabinet. Right now, I've got, at last count, I think there are about 33 ministries.
And it's way too much.
Yeah.
It's way too
and
much.
With
so, yeah, what do you think, Zua, in terms of...
Well, I think, you know, when we... Sorry, did I...
No, carry on.
I think this comes to a governance issue, to be honest, right? So what are the institutions that are needed to efficiently implement policy? So efficiency would mean a very targeted, narrow... focus, no overlap with other ministries that can make issues redundant, and therefore wasting of resources. And I think 33 for a country our size, you know, is a bit much, you know. And I think any government that would look to do things in an efficient way would have to streamline, you know, to again, to efficiently implement the policies. Otherwise, you have people, ministries maybe fighting for a certain area at certain points, not knowing which responsibilities are going to which ministry at other points, and ultimately things not being done. So that's my first take on it. We need to hear what you guys think.
I agree. I just think that, I don't know. I'm sort of, I was thinking of what a new government would do, because I mean, obviously the reason that there's 33 ministries in Zim is because we live with a government that is addicted to political patronage. And if, you know, you have to balance your ducks so that you can keep, power by rewarding your 33 ministers and their deputies, which, you know, at least, and were you counting deputy ministers in that 33? Because I don't think
I said 33 ministries, and you've got a cabinet size including the president and the attorney general of about 64. So there's some ministries without deputy ministers.
Yeah. So, and there's deputy ministers sit in cabinet?
No, deputy ministers don't sit in cabinet. And then you have ministers of state as well, who were your governors before. I don't know if they sit in cabinet, but you've got 33 ministries. That much is clear. And then a full.
Yeah.
But I mean, all these guys get perks and they get, you know, Benzes and they get all these things. And so your full executive is 64. Or thereabout.
So I think it's ridiculous, because obviously the reason, Guy, is that if you have 64, you have enough ministers in each province and areas to coordinate your next campaign. that's really the reason that it's like that. I don't see any other reason for that. But now if you're in stuck with a situation where you're trying to rebuild Zim or to come up with a post, you know, ZANU dispensation, you might need to have a little more than these 12 ministries, because you might need to have something like mining with its own ministry, even though it does overlap with industry and commerce. You might need to have a minister of agriculture with the ambit of agriculture, even though it does overlap. You might need to have a ministry of you know, small and medium enterprises, even though that falls under the Ministry of Finance, purely because you're in a rebuilding or rehabilitative phase and you need, you know, the full-time, you know, focused developmental energies of a political player and his own ministry's resources dedicated to that. But that only works if there's a situation where the people are actually there to do the work or do the job and not just to collect perks.
Yeah, so for me, on this list, you know, they said, you know, you put some of them like tourism with environment and protection. You put mining and agriculture and industry and commerce. I don't think that's a good idea. I think for us, we need to target where our key sectors are. And this is when we are now looking at rebuilding this country. Definitely, we have to cut some ministries. Some of them are really, you know, finance and economic development. You know, you have a ministry of economic development, I think, which is different from finance. You have a ministry of policy coordination, which, and social economic ventures. You know, you have macroeconomic planning and investment promotion. So some of these, you can cut them out. Like, on a very serious note, they're not necessary. But ones I definitely think we have to include is agriculture on its own, because this country, a great part of its economy is on the bedrock of agriculture. You have to have mining on its own, because I think it's a very technical sector and we need to get it right. So it needs to be focused. We have to have energy on its own, because when we start to recapitalize our industries, energy is going to be a big thing. And I think there was one more: mining, energy, agriculture. Yeah, I think that's
But,
it.
The counterpoint to that argument is that why not just put the economic clusters under one ministry of economic redevelopment and have him direct all five policies underneath his ministry. So, you know, you're Chris Ozua, you're Minister of Economic Redevelopment, and you oversee. And then instead of having a minister, you have instead a technocrat. You have a PhD in engineering who spent 50 years of their lives at Rio Tinto overseeing the mining sector.
Because then you have one person. I think you're giving him too much responsibility. And I think in terms of getting things right, you just want someone who's going to be focused on that. I understand, you know, you have a technocrat, but that means this technocrat has to, work with someone, and they have to go and, you know, say, chef, please sign here, and whatever it is. Why not just give this technocrat the job to do what it is that they're supposed to do?
Because I think, for me, it comes back to the issue of efficiency. How can they handle all those clusters under that one ministry, right? Especially if you're someone who's not technically skilled in those areas, right? I look at it as, let's get the blueprint first, you know, of what we feel would work, and then we begin to test to see if that's going to be a way that's efficient or not, you know. Because if we're then going to take all these ministries away and then just add other bodies underneath ministers, if we cluster them, in terms of resource management, i.e. the resources going to those sectors, are we we're not really cutting any fat away, are we? You know, really, we're just sort of putting bodies and reorganizing them in a different way, you know. And we should be forced to do things that actually make sense. And I think the more bodies that are involved, in many instances, it just leads us to be a bit lazy in terms of being efficient. And that's where I stand right now. I'm willing to be convinced, you know, but that's what I feel right now.
I think it's almost a perfect segue into governance, because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that in a lot of countries, government and politicians outsource a lot of their policy making, or not necessarily outsource, but they rely on expert advice. So the Minister of Mining, for example, might, you know, ask the private sector for a white paper on a really complex issue and, you know, use that to incorporate it into their policy making. Or they might ask for suggestions on how to deal with, you know, a tax problem from bankers. So, you know, I think it's a perfect segue into what you do, Zoe, and maybe you can, you know, let the listeners know of what sort of, just exactly what you do, because I think that if people are already thinking about how governments operate, I think that your stuff is incredibly interesting and probably fits in right here perfectly.
Thanks, Henry. Thanks for that. I think... You know, so just a bit of background on myself. I studied, you know, political science and international development in my undergrad. And then I was in Canada, and then I had to do a law degree afterwards, because you can't go into law school straight after upper six, which my father didn't like that. He wanted me to go straight after A-level. And I was in corporate law for a couple of years. And, you know, but my passion has always been, you know, my country, you know, policy, governance in my continent. And, you know, I always was looking around Africa and seeing what's going wrong. Is it that we come up with the wrong policies, or that we have the right policies that are just implemented in the wrong ways? And I really began to delve deep into these things, and I decided that really it's a combination of the two. And we have many, many young Africans, amazing young Africans like yourself and Chris, who are very passionate about getting involved in the decision-making process in their countries. And this idea of Govern Hans Africa came to my mind. And essentially what we do is what we are is an organization of young professional Africans, both at home and in the diaspora, who, number one, propose innovative policy solutions to different ministries and governments across the continent. And then number two, we use our technical abilities in whatever area we are to where we can assist governments in the implementation of either existing policies or the policies that we are involved in trying to push or amend and enhance. And that's what Govern Hands Africa does. And for us, the main theory is how do we efficiently and effectively implement policy that impacts people on the ground, right? So we want a situation where you can have a high-level policy discussed in parliament, passed in, through whatever means in whichever governmental system, but you don't have the institutions to implement it. And not even just institutions, but sometimes the personnel. You know, and again, it's not to say that the personnel are incompetent, but sometimes they don't have the resources, sometimes they haven't had certain exposure. And what we do is we try to collaborate with them. We don't come in to advise and take over certain things outright. We work with ministries, we work with some technocrats in ministries to actually help implement some of these policies. And we've been in operation for about a year and a half now. And, you know, we've had some interesting experiences across the continent, to say the least, you know, from East to West Africa, dealing with places like, you know, the African Union, government of Ethiopia, the government of Senegal, and, you know, just been involved in those different things. So we are about the efficient implementation of innovative and impactful policies, in a nutshell.
Do you have any policies that you can you know, talk about that you guys have worked on? I think it's great, first and foremost, what you guys are doing. You know, to see young people passionate about coming up with policy. And I think it's one aspect that people don't focus on so much, is that we think about the politics of the media. And, you know, what's happening on TV and what's happening on things. But there's a lot that happens behind the scenes in terms of policy. And a lot of our problems are due to bad policy or bad policy implementation, whichever the case might be. So to see young Zimbabweans who are, you know, actively, and you said you've been working for a year and a half and working across the continent, I think it's very commendable what you're doing. So kudos to you.
I think, thanks a lot, Chris. I really appreciate that, man. It's, you know, I think one thing I forgot to mention, which is very important, that we are nonpartisan. We are not concerned with the politics of the government that engages us, because we want to, you know, again, let it be known that we are about what is your policy? Is it going to be impactful on your citizens at the everyday ground level? And how can we ensure that the mechanisms are in place to achieve that? So I just wanted to put that out there as well, just so people know we are not a political organization. We are one that deals with governance and policy efficiency. Now, one of the interesting projects that we've dealt with, and probably my personal favorite so far, was with the government of Senegal. And it was a policy that they've been trying to implement in regards to increasing, again, very, very analogous to Zimbabwe, increasing youth involvement in agribusiness. And they created a facility that had a sizable amount of money and ready to be invested in young entrepreneurs who want to get into agribusiness. So we were invited, along with other professionals and other institutions from across Africa and some from overseas, to engage with the government and create some sort of effective framework to actually achieve this. So, again, going back to, you know, as Chris mentioned, sometimes it's about policy. It's the what are we trying to do. But most of the time it's the how. How are we going to do it? You know, and that is what we were engaging the government of Senegal with. And, you know, we're a small organization, we're a young organization, so our part was, you know, it was bit part as well. You know, we weren't, you know, competing with the World Bank, but we're working with, you know, people from there and people from other organizations like that. But what they wanted was, from a young professional's experience, what can we do to efficiently get these funds through certain mechanisms to these young people? And basically, you know, what we were trying to do was to create a framework that ensured that happened. And that's one of the policies we've been involved with. And again, my personal favorite, because the ministries that we're working with the Ministry of Agriculture, and the Ministry of Youth, there, and the ministers involved were very young and progressive ministers, which was also something very interesting for us to be experiencing in Africa. People who could somewhat relate to that way.
It's unique for
a minister of youth that is
very privileged to have. Who's a youth, a minister of youth that's a youth himself.
In a way, yeah. So I think, you know, it was very refreshing. And again, the way we would set up is we would set up with people who are actually on the ground in Senegal as well as people from our team. So we always make it a collaborative effort. We're not coming in as number one, we're not coming in as non-Africans. Our entire team are young Africans from across the continent, across cultures. And then number two, you know, what we do, like I said, is we engage people who are actually on the ground, who may not be with us on the exec. And, you know, we were able to come up with a recommendation of a framework for the government to hopefully get those funds to people.
So, you know, I have so many questions, but I think in the interest of time, we'll sort of you know, maybe focus on your experiences in as far as, you know, perhaps outside of Senegal, or what do you think some of the challenges are for your service services like yourself being taken up by other governments? Because it's one of those things that it seems like, you know, a lot of our governments could benefit from. And how do you, in terms of, obviously you have to market yourself and everything like that, what kind of resistances have you come across?
Well, that's actually a very good question, and one that I had sleepless nights over trying to find out how I would skirt over them. Number one, we're a small organization now. So our competition is with big consulting firms, you know, the Big Four that engage with governments, McKinsey, BCG, and then of course with the World Bank and African Development Bank. And these are institutions that governments have been dealing with for years upon years, you know, and these organizations have amazing budgets and all of that. So there was that challenge of being able to navigate in a world where these advisors already exist and have very well-established relationships with our governments. And then number two, like I said, we're a young organization, not just in terms of how long we've been operating, but in our age. We're a young group. I think right now the oldest person is just over 40, you know, and the youngest person that we had was about 22, 23 years old. And of course, across our continent, when it comes to discussing how some of our elders can do better, you know, in a said area, coming from a young person, you can imagine the challenges we would face in that regard. But the way we spoke to them, said, listen, we're not here to criticize what you've done or what you're doing. We're here to enhance what you're doing so it can be done better, especially if it's for the impact of the people. And remember, we are young Africans. We're people who actually have a stake in our policies working, because this is our country, this is our continent, and we are the ones who are going to be here after you're gone. So we're not here to represent a foreign government, a foreign international agency. We're here to represent our people as well in terms of the impact that they have. So we brand ourselves as young Africans invested in seeing our governance institutions work efficiently to have policies that impact people. And surprisingly, even if they don't engage us immediately, the conversations that we begin to have are more positive than negative, to be honest, you know, because I think it is an innovative idea. It's a space that, again, was taken up by these mega organizations and much, much older people, you know. But we have very skilled young people with very innovative ideas who just want to contribute towards their country's progress.
That's such a comprehensive answer. You know, just I just have one more question in terms of how you operate. You know, you're competing with these big organizations, and you know, essentially these big organizations are there in place because they serve sort of the global, you know, your neoliberalist or your neo-capitalist, you know, economic system. The reason BCG, the reason PricewaterhouseCoopers, the reason the World Bank, the AFDB Bank, all these people are in Africa and in other areas is because they essentially serve the narrative of, you know, capitalist consumption, like a production method that's at least, you know, in academia, a lot of people say, you know, the World Bank is there because at the end of the day, they want your economy to behave in a certain way so that you can become a member of the international community and produce in a certain way. I just wanted to know what are some of the ideologies, because you may be nonpartisanship, but you have to have some sort of school of thought on how best to implement things. You know, if you're approaching something from, you know, a background where you do believe that individual, you know, production and individual consumption and the market works, then you might decide that, for example, even the Senegal example, you know, you might decide that the best way to go about this is to give loans or give finance and make that finance repayable. But if you're coming from a school where, you know, you might believe in more collectivized or communized thing, you might decide that it's better to have, you know, cooperatives and, you know, have money go to cooperatives. I'm just asking in terms of for me, because it's really important on how Africa is viewed on in the world and how we step into the next century and step into the future. What sort of ideology you use to implement, particularly economic, you know, policies. Even on a personal level, I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
No, I definitely get what you're saying. And it's actually a question that comes up quite often when I discuss with people what it is that we do. And I've always said to people, Governance Africa's ideology is not left or right. It is pragmatism. What works? And I think many times when people think about policy, they immediately think about politics, right? And you know, one could say that's fair enough, because it's very difficult to separate the two. But when you have ideology, this is my personal view, and I'll tell you what I've told my team. What I feel is often the hindrance in progress is when you start from an ideological point of view, not all the time, but many of the time, and then try and fit everything into that view, even if it's not working. So what I have been, I guess, developing in terms of my own view about it over the last few years is, let's stick to what is pragmatic. Whether it ends up being classified as a neoliberal policy, a communist policy, a shinabas, it doesn't matter. Because if we're really trying to impact people's lives on the ground, in the long term, in a positive way, let's do it and do it with what actually works, you know. And there are different contexts and different sectors that may need different approaches. But if we want to blanket all these areas with one ideological view, we've seen across the world, not just in Africa, in other parts of the world, it may not work that way that you intended. And that's the problem I feel with ideology. So from Governance Africa's point of view as an organization, I reiterate, we are not a partisan organization. We are not dealing with necessarily propagating a left or a right kind of approach to things. We're looking at what's going to pragmatically work to impact people's lives. And that's as far as I can take it with what Governance Africa does. And I don't know whether you guys have, you know, Chris, whether you want to comment on what you feel about, you know, the issue of sticking to a certain ideology or going a pragmatic route, or just any thoughts in general about it.
Zo has actually been running this interview, this conversation.
He shouldn't.
Sorry, guys. Like, I didn't know.
It's completely fine.
You can see we have a CEO in the building. Because you're being asked the question.
But it's completely fine. I think this is what we hope to achieve with politics and beyond. You know, people come on, we have a discussion, we ask questions, and we hear different perspectives. I always ask the ideological, we always ask it as well on this show. And I think for me, from a political point of view, it's important because, you know, it sort of takes a view of how you're going to go about your politics. Politics is about people, and it's about, you know, affecting or representing people. And so you must have a certain ideology, especially if you want people to follow you. I think that's where it comes in, is that you need support, and ideology is a great way to build support. But from the policy perspective and what you've said, pragmatism is actually more important than the ideology, in the sense that...
I'll let you come in.
I think it makes sense what you're saying in terms of pragmatism, but then now you're going into philosophical arguments about it. You know, are you utilitarian? So is your policy utilitarian? You know, how many people's lives are you going for? The one that affects the most lives? Are you going for the one that has the best outcome? What is your end game? What are you looking towards? And I think there is, you know, at some point a congruence or a meeting of ideology and that pragmatism, because you're going to have to, if you are going to want to affect the most lives and help, you know, the most number of people, then that's already looking a bit left. But, you know, it depends on what it is. But, you know, pragmatism can be left or right. It doesn't have to be one or the other. But you'll find that dealing with politicians, you know, like you said, they try to then frame the situation towards their ideologies. And sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't work. But I think it's interesting. It's an interesting argument. First time I've thought of it. And I think I need to ponder upon it a lot more and, you know, get a bit more understanding. And then, you know, Henry?
I was asking, you know, I understand the ideological in terms, yeah, it wasn't so much policy, it was more about, you know, what toolbox do you use, as a researcher or as solving a problem is, if you're a lawyer, you have certain tools available to you compared to when you're an economist, and you might approach problems differently. So I think that's more what I was asking in terms of the actual tools you use to solve a policy problem, and those inherently are, you know, ideological, because if you come from a social sciences background, you might be more inclined to, you know, use people's experiences, qualitative data as how you solve a problem. If you come from a hard science or economics background, you're more inclined to use, surveys and hard data to how you solve a problem. So what I meant sort of by ideology in a broader sense is that if you have a certain school of thought already, based on, I can sort of look at your guys, and I'll assume that it's, you know, it's from Canada, so it'll obviously follow a certain school of thought. But I just wanted to know sort of the tools that you have available to you when you approach a problem. And that's sort of, for me, I sort of use ideology in that, but that's really what I meant, is what tools do you have, and what tools does anyone else have, as young people? Do we all, or how can we use our tools our ideas and our ideology personally to impact our, you know, governments, mm-hmm. really.
Well, I think, okay, let me try my best to answer that question. To put it plainly and in a simple way, we use both tools that are qualitative and quantitative. And again, when it comes to pragmatism, it just comes to seeing which toolkit is more appropriate in which analysis for and for what reason, you know. So there are certain sectors where we'll use more qualitative point of view. So let's say when we're in Senegal, we had to use a qualitative perspective in mostly because we wanted to hear what young entrepreneurs in agribusiness were actually feeling and experiencing. And we had to then jump off from that and then start looking at data in terms of, okay, if you're trying to reach X amount of people with X amount of funds, let's see how we can come up with a framework that's going to, you know, given what the feedback has been, achieve the goal of not just the government, but of the needs of the young people. So it becomes a marriage of the two, right? And that's the one thing that, you know, I've been having to, even as I've been on this journey, to learn more, because I'm from a legal background. The tools of analysis are very narrow, you know. We don't deal much with quantitative issues and data and being able to translate data into policy, you know, or use it to effectively give a recommendation that is beyond just a high-level thought, right? But more so about what actually can be done. Move these funds from this sector or this part of the budget to here if you want to actually achieve that, you know. And then when you do have that money, yeah, disseminate this money this way, you know. That's the one thing that, you know, I had to learn more of as I was, you know, growing in this role and growing with the organization. But we do use all of those perspectives. And in particular, going back to, you know, we're incorporated in Canada because, you know, that's where I was when I founded the organization. We're looking to also incorporate here and one or two other places in Africa as well as we continue to grow. But again, what makes us, I feel, unique is that all of us are young on the exec, are young Africans who have been born and raised on this continent and who most of us do work on this continent. So in terms of also the perspectives and schools of thought that inform us, it's a mixture. It's mostly coming from a uniquely African perspective. For example, our vice president and director of publications, Ms. Shingirai Mutero, she is about to finish her PhD at Rose University, and we have such amazing conversations, and she has an amazing perspective when it comes to dealing with these issues from a deeply, deeply African perspective, you know, that challenges the schools of thought that come from either the UK or the States or Canada or what have you. But I think, you know, what makes us rich is that there's a collaboration and sometimes a tussle between the two to get what we feel is the best recommendation put forward to these governments when we deal with them. And again, I hope I've answered the question in a not so long-winded way.
I think that's great.
You have.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Zua, for coming on. I know you came through to the studio because you wanted to observe how we go about our business, but we like to have different people, and the work that you're doing, I think, is important for, you know, other people to hear about. So thank you for sharing that with us. Where can people find you online?
Thank you both. First of all, you can find us at www.govenhanceafrica.org. So www.govenhanceafrica.org. And we are also on Twitter, so govenhanceafrica. We're also on Facebook, govenhanceafrica as well. And also on LinkedIn. And then we also have the personal emails of myself and my exec on there if you need to reach us. But most importantly, if you feel you have a policy issue in your country, in a certain sector that you want to try and address, feel free to email us and we can begin to see how we can possibly move that forward as well.
Fantastic. I think there's a lot of policy issues in this country that need to be addressed.
You know, but yeah.
Beginning with who's the real Nathan Oman is.
Nathaniel Meneru, he unveiled himself at Comrade
Chief. May he please stand up there. Now we want to know, now between Chris and the other Charamba, we want to know who the real Charamba is.
Maybe we don't know.
He unveiled himself, and Henry's been having a good time because the president's spokesperson and the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Information, Comrade George.
It's me, George Charamba.
I swear, you know what? I'm gonna ask Crims to take off my laugh, because if he hears that I've been laughing about this on the show, I don't think it'll go down well. Yeah, but it's him. I think we'll discuss a bit more about it the next time we're here.
In the long run. But yeah, no, thanks so much, Zuat. You know, we asked how to get in contact, but how, you know, what can we do? What can someone listening to this podcast, how do they begin? What can a master student begin to
what
do?
What can you do?
Great question. So, involved, you know, I might have a policy problem I want to fix, but I don't know how to even begin to. Yeah, what should we do before we go?
You know what I think. You know what you just. You know that's the question many people ask. You come to us with that policy issue, and we've already been developing a framework in which we can work with you to present that forward, right? And in terms of other things that we're doing, we're going to start a publication stream where we're going to have some resident writers. On specific policy issues as well. So, master students, if you want to just test out some of your thoughts and your theories, this is just going to be a more informal publication that, you know, you can have a sitting in one of the 8 sectors of gov enhancement, as we call them, and you can, you know, spout some of your thoughts. And then, of course, if you want to do a policy paper with us, that's when, again, you come to us and we're going to work with you in a very rigid way. To get that forward in a way that's well researched and well put forward on your behalf.
Right, thank you very much, Zoa, once again. My name is Christopher Farai Charamba. You can find me at Chris Charamba on all social media.
My name is Maneru, and no, I'm joking.
Go away.
My name is Tawande Henry Beattie, and you can find me at Henry Beattie on all social media. Thank you, Zua. Thanks for being such a great guest, and you did the things that need to be done.
Well, I appreciate it. And you can also find me at Zua Matondo on all social media as well, Twitter, Facebook. Not Instagram, sorry guys.
All right. Capital 263, free to say it.
Free to do it.
Cheers. And now.
Capital 263.